Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good morning. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is legal professor I. Nelson Rose, whose website is gamblinginthelaw.com. We'll be talking to Professor Rose in a few minutes. There is a machine versus human poker tournament going on right now in Pittsburgh. You can watch it online. It's no limit hold'em, subject to the caveat that raises are limited to min raise, half pot, full pot, double pot, and all in. So it's not quite no limit, but it's close. On each hand, no matter how much the player or the machine is ahead or behind, both parties begin with 200 big blinds. I have made two huge $10 bets pending, one with Richard and one with Jeff Wang, our Pot Limit Omaha guest last few weeks. I backed the machine. I'm sure inquiring minds want to know, Richard, how my bets are doing.
Well, the first 2 days, they started 3 days ago, I guess, but I didn't see an update for yesterday. But the first 2 days, three out of the four players are winning, and the players in total are up about 60,000.
Not so good for my $20 at risk. All right, it's still young. Let's talk to our guest. Professor I. Nelson Rose has written almost 2,000 articles on gambling and the law, and his most recent book is Gaming Law in a Nutshell, co-written with Walter P. Champion, Jr. Professor I. Nelson Rose, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Ah, you're one of our favorite guests. You're always invited. So, there's a case in Atlantic City where 14 gamblers noticed a pattern of hands in mini baccarat were exactly the same this shoe as they were the last shoe. At the time, they didn't know why, but this was because the casino and card manufacturer weren't quite on the same page insofar as what pre-shuffled cards were. Gradually, the gamblers increased their bets to the $5,000 table maximum as they became more confident. After 41 consecutive wins and about $1.5 million in winnings, the Golden Nugget pulled the plug on the game. Now, there have been at least four court rulings on this. The first two, issued by the same judge, one said they could keep the money, one said they had to give it back. The last two rulings by a different judge, but the same judge both times, a Superior Court judge, said the players have to give the money back. And this is about 3 years after they won it. Now, the ruling strikes most players totally unfair. Why would they go back to the same judge who ruled against them previously? And are these players toast, or do they have any realistic chances under further appeal?
Well, first, you have to go back to the same judge. There's usually not a choice there. Different court systems work differently, but most of them figure, all right, once the judge knows the case, we don't have to educate the judge. New Jersey, you know, they keep going back to the same judge who ruled that sports betting is illegal. But, you don't have that much choice. Do they have much of a chance? Probably not after losing three of the four cases. In fact, the last three of the four cases. I agree with the players. I think it's unfair. I think it is the duty of the casino to protect the security of the games. And if there's a problem, they should, of course, immediately pull the deck. But let the casino sue the card manufacturer for their idea of random shuffle is, okay, we shuffle it once, and then we're going to use the exact same pattern for every other pre-shuffled deck.
Sounds random to me. Now,
what about even if they do end up having to return the money, shouldn't they have some kind of a false detention case or a violation of civil rights case? Because my impression was they were held for many, many hours and abused.
Well, the law is fairly clear for advantage players, which is that they really cannot backroom you unless they think you're cheating. This one, they probably had enough evidence with 41 hands in a row winning that and making strange plays that I could see them being allowed to hold the players. By the way, I think here's an interesting problem for your audience. If something goes wrong for the casino and you see this weird thing where you go, hey, I know what the next card is going to be, and it's not because it's marked, it's because they're dealing the same cards in the same order. Do you get greedy and try to win 41 hands in a row, a million and a half? But then you might end up giving it back and spending all this money on lawyer's fees, or do you, you know, lose every now and then so that it doesn't look like, hey, I know what the next cards are?
Well, this is really a problem that comes up all the time. There are many people who find a situation that's a potential gold mine, but they don't really understand how to take the money out of the casino. And that's really what separates the professionals from everyone else, is the pros. It's not just, oh, jump on this and win as much as I can. It's how am I going to win the most amount of money and be able to keep it? Because
if there really was that flaw that the
manufacturer was doing this, well, then there's the potential for them to do it again and again and again.
Exactly.
You know? So if you blow it on one shoe, you're certainly not maximizing your win.
I'll give you another example. In the automated Keno game in I think it was in the casino in Niagara, I think. It was on the Canadian side. And a mathematician had figured out they always start with the same number, and then they have this algorithm of random number, you know. And he was able to win quite a few, not the super big jackpots, but he won a lot of smaller jackpots playing Keno, and he got arrested. And his was actually, he was charged with cheating because he was just winning too much. And he didn't realize he shouldn't win two small jackpots in one day, because that's going to, he wasn't doing anything wrong, but it's going to get this unwanted attention. There is something to think about, is that there is the law and then there is the real world. So let's say you are asked to go into the back room and you know that legally they don't have the right to do that. Yeah, if you don't go, you might get beat up. I mean, this happened, right, in Las Vegas. Bad things might happen that are worse. And so I advise clients, okay, make sure you create a record. You stay very clearly. You know, you don't want to do it. You call for the government agent, the control board person to come. But if they are going to put you in the back room, you don't want to have, you know, a bone broken. And there are some bad security guards out there.
Now, back to the Atlantic City, the way it was decided. Does this foreshadow in your mind anything? What's going to happen to Phil Ivey when his edge sorting case comes to trial?
Well, it's the same thing, where they went along with him and violated their own rules, it seems like, with the various ways he was able to read the backs of the cards because they had been miscut. You know, edge, he was doing edge reading, and which is not a crime, again. his case is a little tougher because there may have been some misleading by him or his partner about, well, it's an interesting situation. His partner said, you got to pick the cards up in the exact same way because Phil thinks it's lucky. And one argument is, yeah, it is lucky because then he can read the back of the cards. But, you know, if you get the casino to change the game, then that's a little different from just finding out they made a mistake.
So, but again, it's a free shot for the casino, right? I mean, if they win, great, and if they lose, they want their money back.
It's not good news for the casinos. I mean, I don't have sympathy for casinos that make mistakes and then don't want to pay. But you also have to say, wait a minute, this can literally bankrupt a casino. The recent case where a woman was playing a penny slot machine and it said she won more than $40 million, and the court said, no, you didn't. First of all, the slot machine only pays a maximum of $10,000. And if $40 million was like half of not the profit, but the revenue of the casino, I mean, they literally would have been bankrupt. Now, having said that, in England, the general rule is, yeah, you got to pay. Casino, you made a mistake, you pay, period. And it's certain they have a lot fewer mistakes made.
Well, except in the Phil Ivey case where they're now saying...
Right. Yeah, but again, it's a little different because he got them to change their procedure a little bit. But on slot machines, though, if a slot machine malfunctions, you know, in general, yeah, you got to pay. But they also then aren't going to have the super big jackpots, or at least try not to make those type of mistakes. Now, also, having said that, I have to say casinos and all forms of gambling, lotteries, et cetera, we hear about these incidents because they're so rare. They're so unique. In fact, I used to think that voting machines were pretty good. Now we know, look, if you really want elections to go smoothly, have the slot machine manufacturers make the voting machines. You'll have so fewer errors than with the voting machines they now use.
All right. Let's change topics for a bit. High-stakes poker player Paul Foy and associates, mostly from Malaysia, are accused of taking illegal bets during the World Cup soccer matches last year while staying at some exclusive villas in Caesar's Palace here in Las Vegas. The FBI strongly suspected what they were doing and talked Caesar's Palace into cutting off internet service to the villas.
Right.
Pretending they're internet repairmen, the FBI came in with hidden cameras, filmed a lot of things. They took the film to a judge who issued a warrant, searched the villas. All kinds of evidence was gathered. Very recently, a district court here in Vegas ruled that the cutting off of the internet was an improper ruse, making the search illegal, and he threw out most of the evidence against Foy. So, Professor Rose, what's going to happen now? Is this over, or will the government likely appeal to a higher court?
Well, they certainly will appeal because it's kind of like a sting operation. And the courts understand, they don't always like them, but they understand stings. It's not entrapment unless it's either just so outrageous, you know, like giving a terrorist a real bomb, or there's different standards. One standard is, would the person commit the crime anyway? And the other is, would a reasonable person be committing these crimes? But this isn't enticing a person into committing a crime. It's trying to investigate a crime they think has already happened. In the United States, we are very, very protective of the rights of everybody. So this is really a technicality that the judge has said, you know, the evidence was obtained illegally, therefore you can't use it. If they can't find enough other evidence, and normally you cannot in cases like this, then they do have to let them go. But they will first, the government will first appeal to say this evidence should be allowed. I'm a little bit surprised. I would have guessed, without having studied it in detail, that it looked to me like it's not bad, that that's kind of a typical way. How are you going to, if you walk in and knock on the door and say, can I come in, everything will be hidden. And you certainly won't be able to go and look at their the internet, what they've been doing on their computers. So I'm a little surprised that, that the judge threw it out. But, you know, we're very protective of it, people. We don't like the government just looking at their computers.
I'm kind of shocked that the federal government would be investigating a gambling case in Las Vegas. I mean, it just seems a bizarre use of their resources, and it makes me wonder if the casinos were actually involved in trying to get rid of competition.
Oh, no. No, no. The casinos are not going to be involved in anything like this at all. I think more that the federal government is better suited for this type of investigation because they do this all over the United States. And it's not, nobody's saying that they were cheating the casino or something like that. It's also, it looks like it's got the internet, it's got potentially interstate or international. Maybe they can even think, well, was there more here? Is there money laundering? Is there, if this hadn't happened in Las Vegas, nobody would be surprised that it was the federal government and not the local cops.
Oh, no, I agree with that. It just seems like there are much more important things for them to be, you know, investigating than bookmaking. But I'm curious about Caesar's Palace role in all this. Are you surprised that Caesar's would say, sure, we'll shut off the internet so you can investigate our players?
Oh, no, I'm not surprised at all. The government, both federal and state, have the death penalty. They can end up making sure that somebody like Caesar's loses its license. So there's a lot of self-censorship and maybe a little too eager to help the government in investigations. A few years ago, I wrote about in one of my Gambling in the Law columns that the Treasury had said, you know, those suspicious activity reports that you file every month, well, waiting a month may be too long. And they informally went to mid-level casino floor executives and said, if you see something suspicious going on, call us right away. And, of course, wow. They got the help. They got the help because what are you going to do? You're going to tell the U.S. Treasury, now, we're not cooperating with you. Wow, you really don't want to do that.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, if you're worried about being back-roomed, imagine you tell the United States Treasury to go take a hike. That's not a good idea.
The fact that it happened at Caesar's is probably just incidental. If it could have happened at Bellagio, they have villas, or the Wynn, which are their competitors, and you would guess that those casinos would have acted the same as Caesar's did?
I'm sure they would have acted the same. They probably would have. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if they ran it by their lawyers first, who said, yeah, we don't have any exposure, and you do want to cooperate in a major criminal investigation.
Okay.
It's also kind of interesting that it doesn't even have to have been in a casino. In Macau, one of the weirder things that happened was these guys set up a phony casino in Macau. They took over some rooms of a hotel and made it look like a casino, and the suckers from the mainland China went down there and lost the money. And it was a crooked, phony casino that had no association with any real casino.
Wow.
Okay. Changing subjects again.
I didn't mean to.
No, no. We're going to change subjects. We're going to ask you.
Good.
And I do mean to. Okay. The New Mexico recently became the second state to ban civil asset forfeiture, except basically when somebody's convicted of a crime. Gamblers with money traveling on the highways are very concerned about this. Do you see this stopping a civil forfeiture happening in more and more states?
Well, I don't understand. Why would they be concerned about stopping civil forfeiture?
Because when, especially like I-40, which happens to run through Oklahoma and New Mexico and Arizona, anybody who's stopped by the police can get their car searched. Your civil rights basically go out the window. They will bring in dogs. We'll talk about dogs later. And so there are several police departments who basically, their budget.
They're highway robbers.
Yeah.
Yes, but that's already happening.
What Bob is asking is, do you think that this bodes well for the stopping of this practice?
I mean, New Mexico banned this.
Yes, it's horrible. There was an expose on one of the shows, perhaps 60 Minutes, that, and I believe it was in some of the southern states, where they would stop black drivers and tell them, okay, you know, you can pay us now or we will take your car. And they will take the car. And it would be, you know, related to a traffic incident or some other, you know, perhaps civil forfeitures, I think, are really, really dangerous. The worst is when it's associated with RICO, racketeer influenced corrupt organizations. RICO allows the federal government to basically seize all of your assets, everything, and then you have to prove, although the burden of proof is on the government, but you have to prove everything you bought was with clean money, not with illegally obtained money. And it might be years before you get the items back. I teach criminal law, and I always tell my students that there's these guys who have their cars seized, and when they, sorry, I had to cough.
Mm-hmm.
There were these guys who had, I'm going to have to grab some water. I'm sorry. Can you hold it?
Of course.
Yeah. So while he's coughing, I'll just reiterate that the New Mexico just passed a law that bans the asset forfeiture, so unless you are convicted of a crime. So what'll be interesting is to see if the police actually pay attention to that law, you know, or whether they start ignoring it and seizing assets anyway.
Yeah, what I was saying was that I teach criminal law, and I told my students about these incidents where people had their cars seized, and then 5 years later, they were able to prove they had bought the cars with legal money. It's not the tainted fruit of the poison tree, I think is the expression. So they get their cars back where they had been stored for 5 years near the ocean.
Yeah.
So it was like, here's a plastic bag, and here are the rusty pieces of what was once your car.
Wow. In a related something, maybe, the United States Supreme Court recently voted 6-3 that if you get stopped for a routine traffic violation, you cannot be made to wait until they bring a drug-sniffing dog to the scene because it violates your Fourth Amendment right to illegal searches. The case that this ruling pertained to had nothing to do with civil forfeiture. It was a drug case. But the ruling presumably could be used as such. In their dissents, Justices Thomas and Alioto suggested ways for the police to get around this ruling. In your opinion, Professor Rose, do you see the police easily avoiding this judgment?
It's Alito, by the way. Alioto was the mayor of San Francisco who wanted to be president and didn't get there.
I only got two extra syllables. Come on. But thank you. I apologize.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the conservative, you know, law and order type judges. But the law is really clear that even a temporary stop is a seizure. You can't stop a car and just say, well, I don't like that guy, the way that guy looks, and then ask him a bunch of questions and let him go on his way. You got to at least find, oh, it's a broken taillight, you know? You know, the police, I've been having this discussion with a lot of people because those horrible, horrible cell phone videos are coming out that, you know, it's absolutely shocking to see a guy running away and shot there were 8 shots fired by a cop and killed him in his back, right? The question is, how common is this stuff? Well, it wasn't invented. Police misconduct didn't first come to light in terms of, it wasn't first invented with the invention of the cell phone. It's just that we now see it. And my guess, with more cameras, including the police themselves having more cameras, we're going to find fewer of the really bad incidents happening.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because I know laws have been changing, and, you know, a couple of years ago we were having these discussions about, can you videotape the police? In some states, the police have managed to make it illegal for you to videotape them, and others are not. I mean, what's the is it still like that, where you have to find out what the laws are in every state?
There is a small movement to ban the taping of police, and there is some justification, because what's happening with YouTube is innocent people or others who are stopped for minor incidents are finding themselves being arrested on the internet, and you know, there are some privacy issues, and there's a little bit of a movement to expand that. Certainly the editorials and the much bigger movement is, no, get everything taped, including the inside of vans in Baltimore. Tape everything. You don't have to release it to the YouTube, but you have to keep it forever, so that if there's an investigation, if the police do it, we've got the tape, and if other people do it, well, there are privacy issues, but...
No, but I'm talking about I'm the person stopped, I have the right to tape the cop who has stopped me, or is that a state-by-state issue where, you know, I may end up getting arrested for videotaping the cop who stopped me?
I think it is a state-by-state issue, and I think in general you can do it, but also in general, you don't want to do it unless there's some reason to do it, because otherwise, once again, you're going to piss off the person. You know, you don't mess around with a guy who has a gun.
And well, unless you do it surreptitiously.
Then yes, although that's a little, it's worse, I suppose, if you get caught. But the ones I've seen that happened with a TSA, where he was filming everything, and of course they were getting madder and madder, you know, about it. I think in general, yes, you can do it, and probably the way to do it is to ask him, to say, I am filming this, would you mind if I continue? And if the cop
I don't think there's a cop in the world who's going to say yes.
I'm not going to ask that question. I'm going to film
it. If he says no, then you turn it off. And then there's a big question. Why did he ask you to turn it off?
Well, I'm filming surreptitiously. If something bad happens, show the film to my lawyer. Let him decide whether or not to use it and how. But you can't. You have to film it now, or you have to at least audio it now, because once it's gone, you can't go back and do it. So Audio tape it now. Let the lawyer decide.
The problem is there are anti-eavesdropping laws that say, like, Florida has a horrible one, which is probably still on the books, that says that both sides have to agree. And there was a case where a woman called and she was recording and said, "This guy, my ex-husband, is coming to kill me." And it's all recorded, and the court ruled the law's really clear. We hate it, but you can't introduce that into evidence. He didn't agree to it, and he was found not guilty. Because of, you know, the anti-eavesdropping law says you got to have the permission of both sides.
That's for audio. So video, that may not apply to, right?
Even more so, it would apply.
I think it's normally telephones is what they're thinking of. I guess if you could have a video, it would depend what the law says. Yeah. And frankly, video is obviously better if you can get the audio too.
All right, let's move on to another subject. Not so long ago, New Jersey tried to legalize sports betting in that state.
Yes.
The federal government slapped them down pretty good. There is a Bradley Act that says Nevada can have sports betting, but New Jersey can't. But New Jersey is still trying. Their
right.
governor, Chris Christie, hasn't given up yet. How do you see this getting resolved?
Well, it wasn't actually the federal government. It was the NFL that took them to court, and then the federal court said, hey, the law is clear. What happened is Senator Bradley, former NBA star, becomes a U.S. senator, and he gets this law passed in 1992 by Congress that says the states are frozen into whatever form of sports betting they had in 1991. Now, everybody thinks there's only, you know, three states that have sports betting. It turns out there's a dozen. Because by definition, for example, highlight is not sports betting. Well, it is sports betting. I mean, you can call it whatever you want, but and there's some other forms. But the law is very clear. I think it is also unconstitutional. This is another example of they went in front of a judge. The judge says, no, New Jersey, the law is constitutional. You didn't have sports betting in 1991. You can't legalize it now. Well, they go back in front of the same judge, you know, and they're back in front of the same court of appeals. I think it's a wrong decision, but it's binding, at least on that part of the East Coast, that says, hey, you can't have sports betting unless you had it in 1991. And the only way to change it is where you can try what New Jersey did, which is, okay, well, we won't legalize, we won't regulate and authorize sports betting. We'll just eliminate all of the laws against sports betting. I work, besides working with, you know, private parties and industry, I also work with the government. And I actually was talking to an FBI agent I've known for many years. I said, hey, how many cases do you now have in New Jersey? And he says, oh, we got three. So nobody is going to eliminate true illegal sports betting. What they did in New Jersey is they said, well, we're eliminating the laws against sports betting, but only in casinos and racetracks and only by people we like. And come on, I mean, that's regulating, that's authorizing it. So I don't think that will work. So the only other way you can get sports betting, one way is to try to outlaw, just eliminate all your laws against it, which isn't going to happen. The other is to get an act of Congress. Well, Congress doesn't pass any laws anymore. And the other is to get a court case from a different part of the country, come to a different decision, and then go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that is years and years away from happening.
You know, you mentioned that it was the NFL that smacked them down, but
right. The
NBA has been very vocal in coming out in support of legalized sports betting, and I'm wondering why are they out in front of this? Why are they pushing for it, but everyone else or the other sports are against it?
Well, I think they're being more realistic, and they're not hypocritical. look, football was not a big spectator sport in the United States for television until the tax for legal bookies was reduced, and it started to be shown on Monday nights. And all of a sudden, it took off to the point where you've got these giant sports books in the casinos in Nevada. And look, if they, the horse racing industry does the same thing. They think it has nothing to do with gambling. I told them, okay, have some horse races and don't let people bet, and let's see how many people show up.
You know?
Yeah. So what is happening with sports betting in the United States is a shift. The NBA is the biggest one because they actually shifted all the way to coming in favor of legal sports betting. The rest of the leagues are saying, we're against sports betting, but fantasy sports is pretty cool because people have to continue to watch even when the game is a blowout. So they love fantasy sports, and we now have got basketball, baseball, and hockey officially joining for money with fantasy sports, and even the NFL is in favor of it, or at least not actively opposed.
Now, couldn't the casinos in New Jersey get into the fantasy sport business? Maybe even do it the way the horse racing, where they pass the money through, you know, almost like, you know, pass the money through to the tracks and take a cut off the top? I mean, that would be legal for them, wouldn't it?
Yes, although the interesting rule in Nevada is that it's got to be a game of chance. And so one of the arguments is there's too much skill. But I was just on a panel with the lawyer for MGM, and he got that question, and he said, yeah, we looked at it. We think it is gambling, which means we need government approval, and it just doesn't. And also there was a guy from one of the big sports books. They don't do fantasy sports because it's too slow. It's not interesting. Or if you're in the gambling business, you want to go the opposite way. You want in-play bets. You want to know if the quarterback's going to run left, right, or center and take money on that for the next 15 seconds, not one day or 3 days or a season. That's just too slow for them.
Well, but it would be a way for them to enter the market, in New Jersey at least.
Yeah, but there's an interesting question. It's exploding. What happened was the invention of daily fantasy sports was like the invention of the under table lipstick camera for poker. It has caused an explosion of interest. But daily fantasy isn't season-long fantasy. There is some real questions about whether it's got too much chance. But there's a lot of interest. I've been on like three or four panels in the last 4 or 5 months dealing with fantasy sports. And one of the things that the people who run it say is it's not 100% overlap. That there's a lot of overlap, but a lot of those people aren't gamblers. You know, some real significant percentage like the idea of, certainly season-long, you get to be a manager. But even day-long, you're not betting, you're like playing poker. It's, you know, you're not betting on what the next card will be. You're involved in almost a tournament.
Right.
But, FanDuel has the lion's share of the daily fantasy sports. But DraftKings is in second place, and they're owned by ESPN and Disney.
Disney just put in tens of millions of dollars on it.
I mean,
now is Disney dancing around saying this isn't gambling?
No. Remember the leagues. You've got baseball, hockey, and basketball all now have money in fantasy sports, and they are saying this is not gambling, and they love it because they get more viewers. And the players like it because, the team players like having their names out there, and they would like to get some share of the revenue of that. I personally think, this is my prediction of what's going to happen. I think that fantasy sports is a way to have something like sports betting without having to repeal the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, without having to the leagues to say that they're in favor of sports betting. So it's something really similar. The question is going to be, can you really do dailies? And I think by statute, they're going to say daily may be a little too much. We want people to be able, for example, to make trades, to be pretend to be a manager. And, you know, I may be wrong. There's a little movement. A few states have actually passed laws clearly outlawing fantasy sports, but there's more states that are passing laws to clearly legalize fantasy sports.
All right. We've been talking to Professor I. Nelson Rose. We're pretty much out of time for the interview segment of the show. We didn't come close to getting through our list of questions. So consider yourself invited back as soon as you can fit us into your schedule. Our guests, our audience loves to hear. This is you're one of our favorite guests.
So, oh, well, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Let's talk about our commercials, our sponsors. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else has. Throughout the rest of April, which is a couple days now, there's through Wednesday, there's a $500,000 swipe, spin, and win promotion. Play 300 points, go to a kiosk, spin a virtual wheel. Prizes, I've played all month. On both my card and Bonnie's card, which is legal there. And the prizes have averaged a little over $20. Today I ran bad. I got $10 food credit and a free breakfast buffet. So that was less than $20 a piece. But yesterday I got two $25 free plays each. The day before I got a 50 and a something. So anyway, it's averaged over 20. It's a good, smaller roller play. At the Palms, 7 p.m. drawings, $10,000 on Friday, $10,000 giveaway. Don't need to be there to win, need to collect before midnight. They have ticket multipliers Friday afternoon and evening. And play for prizes. This week is a little bit different than they usually have. This week you earn money to buy leftover gifts. They give away gifts periodically. Under the polite term we call it is casino crap. But every now and then, there's some things that appeal to some players. And so, like, if they have a dish set and you want it, I mean, one dish set doesn't do you any good, but if you could get four of them or eight of them or something, it would be nice. Well, this time you have the chance to do that. So for this week, for very low prices compared to what they cost when they're originally given, you can buy these gifts. Starting next week, they'll be back to their normal play for prizes. And next week, for 2 weeks, is going to be Walgreens. And the following 2 weeks after that will be Fresh and Easy, which is a healthy fast food supermarket, sort of, I guess you could say it, here in Nevada. The gift cards will be 0.2%. You keep your points. VideoPoker.com. It's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month, $79.95 a year. It allows you to get corrections on most games, most notably quick quads. It also allows you to practice games that you don't find anywhere else. So if you see it in a casino and you haven't never played it before, you have a chance to go in and play for free to get a sense as to what the game is about and work out your strategy. Every week they have a game of the week where you play for real prizes, real money. And this week it is Ultimate X. Ultimate X is a 10 coin per line game, where each winning hand you get, if you're playing 10 play, you have each of the 10 lines is separate. Each of the winning hands you get gives you a multiplier for the next hand. And so your play is changed from normal strategy because you're playing both for now and for the next time. And so it's a combined strategy. It is a quite a fascinating game. But anyway, that's the game of the week this time. All right, next week, our guest is going to be Bob Loeb, also an attorney from the land of Lincoln. So what do you know about Bob Loeb?
Well, so Bob Loeb is actually a trial lawyer, represents players in many cases. He's from Chicago. He, with Professor Rose, wrote the book Blackjack and the Law. And he has a couple of interesting cases. One in, and we'll find out what the status of those cases is, but one is the players in Illinois that were arrested for playing a hole card, and the prosecutor is trying to say that hole carding is cheating. So that's a really important case for players across the United States. And then another one of his cases is the guys who had the $400,000 seized in Arizona after they had been playing these Keno machines that they had found a vulnerability. And they had dozens and dozens of charges of computer hacking. And, I mean, they just pulled out every law in the book to try to throw at these guys for beating these Keno machines. I think all of those charges have been dropped, but we'll find out. So that's a little bit about Bob. He'll be here next week.
I'm actually going to ask him to listen to today's broadcast and see if he would have answered any of the questions that Professor Rose did differently.
Right.
I don't expect them to argue a lot with each other, but each attorney has
his own flair. And we'll definitely be talking to him more about asset forfeiture because, you know, he's had a number of those cases in different states. So
all right. Now, the following week, we're talking to Ed Miller. Ed Miller has written a number of books about low-limit poker. He's finally created his masterpiece on a book called The Course. And we're going to be talking to him about this book. Have you read much of that book yet?
You know, I'm halfway through it. I don't know that I would call it his masterpiece, but it so far to me it is absolutely the first book I would recommend for somebody who wants to try to beat low limit, no limit hold'em here. You know, playing live. You know what I mean? He really kind of sets out, for a beginner, a way that you can go out and actually make money playing no limit hold'em at small stakes. And I think he just really nailed it. As I say, I'm only halfway through, but
as am I. And I suspect I'm learning more from it than you are, because a lot of it you already knew. But I'm actually enjoying it. I was reading Jeff Huang's Pot Limit Omaha books for the last several weeks. And so now I'm sending. Now I'm going into back to no limit hold'em. So I'm not really that much of a poker player, as in not at all. And so I'm just spending all my time reading these poker books.
Well, he's a good writer, so it's it stays entertaining anyway. So.
He is, but the concepts in no limit are considerably different than they are in Pot Limit Omaha.
Yeah.
All right, then we have a man named Limon who's coming in the near future.
Lyman, I don't know. He's his real name is Abe. He's also a Pot Limit Omaha player in Los Angeles. He has his own podcast, apparently. I haven't heard it yet, but seems like a bit of a wild and crazy guy. But anyway, yeah, he'll be on. I'm not sure if it's exactly in 3 weeks, sometime before the World Series. He'll be here, so yeah.
All right. The World Series is coming up soon.
Oh, wait, before we get to that, I just want to say that I'm also really actively trying to get someone that makes money at Daily Fantasy Sports on the show, I'm having a really hard time. So if any of our listeners knows somebody
or willing, is somebody
willing to come on the show, you know, the problem is that the Daily, the FanDuel and DraftKings balk when they hear the word gambling with an edge, because they all are pretending like it's not gambling. And the guys who are actually making the money at it don't want to come on the air because they're making so much money on it, they don't want other people getting into it. But really, right now, Daily Fantasy Sports, I think, is bigger and easier than online poker was when the online poker boom first started. So eventually we'll find somebody willing to come on and talk about it.
Well, you have a real close friend who's at least playing at a minor level. Would he even have enough information?
Well, he just started. He just started. So, and actually, I did talk about that. I did mention that to him, and he said to me, "Well, I understand why they don't want to go on the air. I wouldn't either."
So, thanks a lot.
Yeah. So.
All right. So we have almost 2 minutes to go, Richard. So how can people hear about our?
Okay, so first of all, we really like getting questions from the listeners, so you can send those to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge, or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. If you want the show delivered as you sleep, you can sign up at YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, or at richardmunchkin.com, and every week it'll get delivered to you automatically. Or you can find an archive of all the past shows at bobdancer.com.
All right. I haven't noticed any difference so far between our Tuesday morning show compared to our Thursday night show. I don't know if our listeners have noticed a difference.
I just got one email that somebody saying, "I got the show delivered just the way I normally do." So, yeah, everything seems to be going along smoothly.
All right. So thank you, Professor I. Nelson Rose. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.
Gives a wink and then it goes too far. We're out on the dance.